From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The Democratic National Committee has announced how the 20 candidates in the two nights of debates coming up will be arranged. We'll talk about the fields and how they might line up against each other. Also, a look at the California state budget and its priorities, all coming up right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope you have a nice weekend planned. We've got a lot of movies for you to choose from on Film Week coming up with our critics next hour. We'll hear what they think about the brand new Shaft film. Samuel L. Jackson returns to the title character role. Jesse T. Usher also co-stars, and the original Shaft, Richard Roundtree, in the cast. Also, Men in Black International, starring Tessa Thompson and Chris Hemsworth, and the new documentary from Martin Scorsese, Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story. That's just the start of the films that we'll have to review coming up next hour. Later this hour, we'll talk about how the two nights of Democratic candidate debates have been set. The Democratic National Committee announced just about 25 minutes ago what the lineup will be for June 26th and June 27th. They'll break the 20 candidates, the qualified, into groups of 10 each, and we'll talk about that. But we begin with the passage of the state budget. Earlier this week, we talked about the deal that was reached between Democratic leaders of the legislature and Governor Gavin Newsom. Now we have the budget itself passed, and with us from CalMatters, staff reporter who covers the economy, finance, and the budget, Judy Lynn. Judy, good morning.
Nice to be here.
Let's start with, first of all, the size of this. Is this a record large budget spending-wise?
Indeed, it is. It's a whopping $215 billion when you account for all the state's discretionary funds, special funds, and bond money that comes into the state.
And this, of course, in response to it being a very good revenue year, and we'll talk with H.D. Palmer about that momentarily. But this is a case with the supermajority Democrats have in the legislature. They don't need Republican support. And this was a straight party line vote. Democrats all in favor, Republicans all opposed.
Yes. As expected, the Republicans, no Republicans supported this bill, and it was passed by a straight majority of Democrats, and that's all they needed.
Let's start with health care. And here there is a state mandate that California has implemented that everyone have health insurance. And Medi-Cal is being expanded to young adult undocumented Californians. What's the cost of expanding Medi-Cal up to age 25?
Yeah. So on that, you know, this is a step that a progressive California is taking to get to health care coverage for all. The state already under Jerry Brown had expanded Medi-Cal to adults without children without legal status and up to 18. And now this move incorporates the young adults ages 19 to 25. And it's a cost of $98 million a year, because we're expecting about 90,000 people to qualify. So those are the rough numbers. They're significant, but by California's 40 million population standards, it's not the biggest movers.
Also with us, as I mentioned, H.D. Palmer of California's Department of Finance. H.D., good to have you with us again.
Hey, Larry. Great to be back.
Let's talk about the paying for the Medi-Cal expansion here. Is there concern, since the state has to pick up the full cost of this, federal dollars don't go toward coverage of undocumented Californians, is there concern that as revenues might decline in the future, there won't be the money to cover up to age 25?
We've looked at a multi-year projection of the state's finances, and we believe that we can accommodate the spending within that window. A couple of notes on that. One is that whether these individuals are undocumented or not, it's important to note that a lot of the care can come from more costly services that are provided through emergency rooms. So despite the citizenship status, it is far more effective and less costly to provide treatment through a primary care physician than it is to do it through an ER. And actually, the federal government does provide reimbursement to states for the cost of emergency and pregnancy-related services to individuals regarding their citizenship status through Medicaid, which is California is known as Medi-Cal, and that's a federal law that dates back to the Reagan administration.
HD, Republicans have expressed concern that the revenue in California is so volatile. As we know, it's highly dependent on what sorts of revenue is being generated by the highest tier economically of Californians. Do you have any concerns that as ambitious in spending as this budget is, that it's setting up programs that are going to have to be ratcheted back in years to come, if not Medi-Cal, other programs?
First of all, Larry, the Governor Newsom is extremely aware of the volatility of the state's revenue. That's why he put a significant amount of dollars in this budget into reserve. The total amounts are about $19.2 billion that are going into various budget reserves, whether it's the traditional budget reserve or special fund for economic uncertainties, whether it's the new social safety net reserve for healthy human service programs, whether it's the reserve that's going for schools. So there's a significant amount of money that's going into reserve with a recognition that, as you noted and others have, that the revenue system is very volatile. One of the things that the governor also insisted on in terms of any new spending is that we know that our fortunes can change rather quickly, depending upon, for example, what happens with the financial markets. So the governor insisted on a number of these programs having a suspension clause built into them so that the spending will occur and then suspend in 3 years. There are roughly 20 programs that are affected by the suspension provision, so that if our fortunes change and if we have to revisit these programs, then there's going to take an affirmative vote of the legislature to renew spending for those. So we've got a built-in spending circuit breaker that's in there at the governor's insistence. Plus, we've got a significant amount of money that is built into what's called, the governor refers to as budget resiliency, which is paying off debt, building up our reserves, and paying down a number of the liabilities that we have, for example, in the state's pension system, ahead of schedule. So a significant amount of money is going into that so-called budget resiliency. As a share of it, it's well more than half of the estimated surplus of $21.5 billion that's going into that reserve, that those types of paying down debt, paying off obligations and things of that sort.
Want to open it up to listeners. If you have questions about the California budget just passed by the legislature following agreement reached with Governor Newsom, we're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We have a question, maybe HD you can answer, JSCast. The cost time bomb of Medi-Cal for seniors was dropped, but is capitation coverage for young adults really only just over $1,000 each?
Well, that is somebody who is asking a question that is very versed in the intricacies of Medi-Cal.
Going to say.
It is the second largest program that, in terms of a share of general fund that the state spends right after K-12 education. One of the things that the governor is pushing for that'll hopefully reduce the cost in Medi-Cal and reduce the cost to its consumers is reducing the cost of prescription drugs. He has entered into agreements with several counties in terms of trying to leverage the state's purchasing power so that we can provide prescription drugs in a much more economical way to Medi-Cal recipients. And that's a significant amount of the Medi-Cal cost. We've got roughly 14 million Californians out of 40 million who receive their health care through Medi-Cal, roughly one in three. So the governor will continue his efforts to see how we can continue to make health care more accessible but more affordable at the same time. And there's one of the areas in Medi-Cal that he's been very active on since taking office in January is on the issue of the cost of prescription drugs.
HD, also wanted to ask you about paid family leave expansion there, that passed in this budget?
Yes, it did. We're looking to increase the time on the state's paid family leave by 2 weeks. That'll be done by drawing down the reserves in the Disability Insurance Fund in a manner that still provides an ample and adequate cushion for that. But that's something that, that the governor has indicated as he was seeking office, that he was going to go forward and push in terms of his family agenda, and it's something that the legislature concurred with.
Is the cap-and-trade money going to go toward the water cleanup for Central Valley communities with contaminated household water sources?
There is a provision that is in the budget to direct about $100 million in so-called cap-and-trade revenues to begin to implement a safe and affordable drinking water program that's going to provide a stable, ongoing fund source. It's important to note that despite more than $3 billion in investments that we've made in the state for state drinking water since 2010, many water systems throughout the state, particularly those that are serving small and disadvantaged communities, are failing to provide safe drinking water to their customers. About 1 million Californians right now lack access to safe drinking water. And that's something that the governor really shined a spotlight on, if you remember his State of the State address back in January. So we believe that this is an appropriate use of these dollars to provide a stable and ongoing fund source for safe and affordable drinking water. And we believe that it's an appropriate use as well because it advances the state's climate resiliency goals by helping to secure water resources statewide. And the legislature at the end of the day concurred in the governor's view on that.
Judy Lynn of Cal Matters, staff reporter, want to come back to you about education. There is additional educational funding here, but what about efforts to rein in the growth of charter schools in public school districts? What's happened with that legislation?
So that is moving forward. There was a request in by the administration to prohibit charter schools from blocking or disenrolling special education students. They tend to require more support for their disabilities. And lawmakers did embrace that change, and that is in the budget. And that is concurrent with some of the other legislation that's being proposed and moving through the regular session of the legislature.
And Judy, just real quickly in closing, what was the most contentious of this issue where you had division among Democrats?
Yeah, I would say there are some issues still outstanding. There's tax conformity, this proposal from the administration to update our state tax codes to align with the federal changes that were made by Republicans in Congress in 2017. In doing so, it would raise some taxes for businesses by reducing their deductions. So that is an outstanding issue that still needs to be worked out because some Democrats in swing districts are concerned that, it would look like a tax and they could be recalled. And there's that fear hanging out there.
Judy Lynn, staff reporter for Cal Matters. Good to have you with us. And H.D. Palmer, California Department of Finance. Thank you, H.D., for joining us as well. Coming up, we'll take a look at the legislative battle over whether ride-hailing company drivers should be classified as employees instead of independent contractors. And if they end up being employees in California, are ride-hailing companies economically viable? Can they provide the benefits, higher compensation that would likely come from employee status, and keep fares low enough that people will use ride-hailing companies? We'll talk about that back in 1 minute. We now know the two-night lineups for the NBC, MSNBC Democratic candidate debates that come up in less than 2 weeks. A little bit later this hour, we'll talk about the 10 and 10 groupings of the candidates over the two nights. But I also want to let you know Film Week comes up at 11 o'clock. Our critics will review the new Shaft, directed by Tim Story. Kenya Barris and Alex Barno are the screenwriters. Samuel L. Jackson, Jesse T. Usher, and the original Shaft. I guess you call him the OS. Richard Roundtree, also in the cast of the new Shaft. And we'll hear about the documentary Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese. But right now, we turn our attention to the ongoing negotiations in Sacramento over whether ride-hailing companies, Uber and Lyft, have a relationship with their drivers that is an employee-employer relationship and not an independent contractor relationship. As a result of the state Supreme Court's Dynamex decision, the drivers are potentially employees. The question is how the California legislature is going to ultimately determine whether they stay as independent contractors or become employees, subject to all the benefits and protections that would come with that. And then the question is, are ride-hailing companies economically viable if their drivers have employee status? With a San Francisco Chronicle reporter covering the on-demand economy, Carolyn Saeed. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So where do we stand now? I know Uber and Lyft are actually teaming up on legislation that would give them a break on this. What would the bill do?
So AB 5, the bill which has already passed the Assembly and is now headed to the Senate, basically codifies and clarifies the Dynamex decision. Technically, Dynamex is the law of the land of California because it was a unanimous decision from the California Supreme Court. However, it has not yet resulted in any dramatic changes. It's just, you know, there have been some cases here and there that have gone through the courts and as a result of Dynamex have resulted in people being reclassified. But it hasn't made any, it didn't wave a magic wand and change everything in California overnight. AB 5 has the potential to do that by making it much more clear who Dynamex does and does not apply to. There are a lot of exemptions in AB 5, mainly for professionals who set their own rates, like doctors and dentists and architects and lawyers and even hairdressers and barbers. But the author of AB 5 is vehemently opposed to exempting Uber and Lyft drivers because they don't set their own rates and they don't have control over their working conditions, as she says. Uber and Lyft, on the other hand, are vehemently opposed to making the drivers employees, which is what they have now teamed up to campaign against.
So is anyone in the legislature sort of carrying the Uber-Lyft argument that they should be exempt? Do they have people that are backing their position, or is this a tough sell?
Well, you know, that 11 members of the Assembly voted against AB 5, and I haven't counted them up, but I believe they were all Republicans. And you know, it is the whole business community is allied with Uber and Lyft. The whole business community is against AB 5. The California Chamber of Commerce, TechNet, all the big associations that represent businesses are opposed to this. On the legislative side, it's not clear yet.
And is there any alternative bill or tweak to SB 5 that would carve out, or I should say AB 5 that would carve out ride-hailing exemptions?
There is not at this time, but that's what Uber and Lyft are campaigning to try to get. What they want, they want a bill that would exempt them from the Dynamex decision, and in exchange, they're offering what they consider significant concessions and changes for the drivers. They're offering to guarantee a base wage after expenses. They're offering to have some kind of flexible benefits pot where drivers could sort of pick a la carte, like a younger driver might not want retirement benefits but might want insurance or paid time off. And they're offering to have a driver's association that would act as sort of the voice of drivers and would handle things like administering those benefits and would handle appeals when drivers get deactivated or kicked off the platform.
Have either of the companies said what the effect would be on fares if they were required under Dynamex to treat their employees or drivers as employees if they are not exempted? Have they said how that would affect their business model?
So they have both said, basically the heads of Uber and Lyft wrote an op-ed in the Chronicle on Tuesday, and they said, quote, "It's no secret that a change to the employment classification of our drivers would also pose a risk to our businesses." They've said that in all their filings when they went public, that if their drivers were reclassified as employees, it would add significantly to their business expenses and potentially hurt their model. And it's not just expenses. It's also the flexibility of the drivers being able to log on and log off whenever they want. Uber and Lyft say, and it is true, that there is no existing model in America, really, for this, of you know, people at McDonald's are scheduled on shifts. They might be working part-time and intermittently, but they get scheduled well in advance and told when to report for work. On the other hand, the proponents of AB 5 says just because the model doesn't exist doesn't mean that it couldn't exist, that it could potentially be possible to be an employee and be able to clock in and clock out whenever you want. But Uber and Lyft fear that that wouldn't work for a variety of reasons. So, both and in terms of raising fares, they have not said specifically that they would raise fares, but it would make sense that they would have to pass along some of those additional costs to riders.
And has there been an effect on their stocks as it seems like the companies are not necessarily making headway in Sacramento?
Well, their stocks are already doing very badly. It's hard to sort of differentiate and tease out whether they're doing badly because of what's happening in Sacramento or whether they're doing badly because neither company has ever generated a penny in profit and neither has a very clear path to generate any profit in the next 2 years. So their stocks both quickly sank on Wall Street, but I think that there's, even larger macroeconomic forces at work there, but this certainly doesn't help it.
And no profit, even with the drivers being independent contractors currently.
Yeah.
All right. Carolyn Saeed, San Francisco Chronicle reporter. Let me bring into the conversation Stanford University economics professor Paul Oyer. He actually became an Uber driver to better understand its business model from the driver perspective. Professor, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
If Dynamex ends up applying in full to Uber and Lyft drivers, that they have all the protections of employees and are not independent contractors, do you think that these companies can economically survive?
So, first of all, I think everything Caroline said was exactly spot on. And just to add a little bit to that, that reflects on your question, it's already a question of how these companies are going to survive. They don't have as she pointed out, they haven't sort of shown us a sustainable business model yet in any case. So exactly how much cost Dynamex would add or whatever sorts of benefits they're going to talk about adding, how that would reflect on their business model, it's a little hard to say because we don't even know what base business model is going to work for them in the future in any case. I think that whether or not they get forced into adding more benefits, what we see now for their drivers is an ongoing negotiation, as it were, between this large group of people who drive for them and the companies at what is a reasonable rate we can pay such that the drivers will continue to be willing to do it and the business can find a sustainable business model. So adding the Dynamex decision and the types of things that the op-ed piece in the Chronicle talked about in terms of what the two ride-sharing firms might offer, adding those things certainly is going to be a challenge, an additional challenge, but they have a ways to go to figure out what is a sustainable business model in any case.
Now, there are those who think what really the long-term play here is that the ride-hailing companies are counting on having fully autonomous vehicles and not needing human drivers at all. Do you think that that's the likely strategy here? And if that is, that seems to be a risky strategy, that the economic model of that would work.
Yeah, I mean, that's a long way off, and I'm no expert in this. I don't know if long way means 5 years or 20 years, but when they are going to have drivers for a while. Yeah, I'm guessing by all indications, they're looking forward to the day where Lyft and Ubers will be provided autonomously, but they have to find something in the interim, which is both a viable business model and, works for everybody.
We're talking with Stanford University economics professor Paul Oyer, also with us from NYU, New York University, professor of entrepreneurship and technology, Arun Sundarajan, also author of the book The Sharing Economy, which was published about 3 years ago. Professor, good to have you with us.
Great to be on, Larry.
What's your sense of the viability of these companies long term, particularly if the Dynamex decision ends up applying in full and their drivers end up classified as employees?
Well, I think both Uber and Lyft do have a viable business model in the short run and the long run. I've been trying to follow their operating margins in the big cities, which is where a bulk of their business is right now. And it seems like they are investing in growth rather than taking profits, and that sort of seems like the right business strategy. But if they pulled back and said, okay, we're going to sort of get onto a path to profitability, they certainly would be able to, albeit sort of like, you know, at a smaller scale than they've promised. I think what Dynamics does is that it actually affects smaller platforms far more than it will affect Uber and Lyft. I think if you're a large enough platform, you can absorb some of the extra cost. You can spread the demand across, like, you know, drivers who are driving 40, 50-hour work weeks much more readily than, say, a newer platform that might be relying on part-time work. So it would have been a lot harder for these platforms to get off the ground if they had to hire drivers as full-time employers. Fares will go up probably 20-30%. But I think the big economic implication will be that, you know, their market size goes down because the set of consumers who are willing to pay the higher fares is smaller, but also barriers to entry go up. It becomes much harder for a new platform to come along. I do agree with what Carolyn and Paul have said, and in particular about the fact that, you know, Paul mentioned that fully autonomous vehicles are a ways off. I think 20 years is a better estimate than 5 years. You know, of course, we're going to have improvements in technology, but there's a whole bunch of social and political factors that need to align before mass market. We're letting cars without drivers pick people up. And so I wouldn't bet a business model on that happening anytime soon.
Yeah, to get a whole fleet of vehicles that are fully autonomous up and available, you're looking at a huge infrastructure and technological challenge, no question. We're talking with NYU Professor of Entrepreneurship and Technology, Arun Sundarajan. Also with us, Paul Oyer, Stanford University economist, and Carolyn Saeed, who focuses on the on-demand economy for the San Francisco Chronicle. If you have questions for our guests about the financial future of ride-hailing companies, particularly as the companies are trying to lobby the state legislature to exempt them from the Dynamex State Supreme Court decision, which effectively classifies their drivers as employees. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. And my question for you is, if you are a heavy user of ride-hailing companies like Uber and Lyft, how much of a price increase, percentage-wise, do you think you would be able to absorb to keep using Uber and Lyft in the way that you do? And how much would it depress your usage of ride-hailing companies? What sort of, for you, is the point of sensitivity where you would change how you actually use the apps? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Carolyn, I don't know if we have any statistics on different types of ride-hailing customers, but I'm sure there are some who just sort of build in the cost of this because it's sort of de facto subsidized at a loss at this point, who would you know, go out and buy a car, for example, if the fares go up appreciably.
Well, that is a very good question. I think that people who are that price sensitive would, rather than buying a car, would go to public transit and you know, sacrifice some time. But it is very true, as you said, that these rides are already being subsidized by venture capitalists. And now that the companies are public, public market investors are not going to have the same appetite for helping everybody in America get a $10 ride to the airport that actually should cost $30.
Carolyn, thanks so much. I know you're working on Deadline as always. We appreciate your being with us on Air Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Carolyn Saeed, San Francisco Chronicle reporter. We'll continue with our economists from Stanford University, Professor Paul Oyer, and Professor of Entrepreneurship and Technology at NYU, Arun Sundarajan. We'll talk with both professors as we continue. And again, our lines are open for you to ask them questions about the future of the ride-hailing companies Lyft and Uber, and particularly if you're someone who's heavily dependent on one or both companies to get around.
How much of a price increase could you absorb if compensation for drivers goes up and fares follow? 866-893-KPCC. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdes. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll talk about the Democratic National Committee's decision about how they're breaking up the field of 20 qualifying candidates for the first two nights of debates. It's group of 10, and the chemistry, how they match up with each other should be interesting. We'll talk about who's on which particular night of the debates a little bit later this hour. But right now, as the negotiations go on in Sacramento, the question is, if ride-hailing companies Lyft and Uber are not exempted from the state Supreme Court's Dynamex decision, which says that the drivers are employees, not independent contractors, are the ride-hailing companies economically viable? If they are going to be treating their drivers as employees, what would have to happen with fares to provide the benefits that would come with that? And at that point, would there be significant loss in ridership as fares increase? Jesus in El Segundo, I understand you drive for both of the companies. Your question, please.
Larry, hello. My question is, I don't understand why the company says, you know, that we're self-contractors. I would prefer to be an employee because I pay, honestly, like $15 a day just for insurance. And my insurance is very limited, yet we work 10, 12 hours a day, and insurance adds up really fast. I'm hoping that something gets done, something gets better. Because we honestly cannot be living like this. It's really expensive for us as drivers.
Yeah.
On top of that, we got our gas expenses and our maintenance of our vehicles. And I'm hoping that, you know, something gets done.
Yeah, Jesus, I appreciate it very much, and thank you for sharing your concerns. We have heard this consistently from drivers. Paul Oyer, you yourself were a driver, and after having done it yourself, do you wonder how drivers make it financially?
I mean, I think what Jesus is an important data point, as are many drivers. I mean, it's in order for this business model to work, the drivers cannot make a ton of money. And finding exactly that sweet spot where people like Jesus are willing to continue to do this, given their other options. And right now with unemployment at, 3.6% and the job market being really hot, Uber and Lyft face a real issue trying to get people to stick with this job. And doing that, you know, we'd love to see the drivers make more money. But as we talked about before the break, there's definitely a trade-off there between the fact that the fares are so reasonable.
What was your experience as a driver? What did you think of your relationship with the company as you were driving for it?
Well, now, you know, I was very lucky. I was doing this more as an experiment to understand the driver's incentives and what they face as part so that I could do a research study. You know, I didn't have to make a living this way. And so it's a little bit unfair to sort of, you know, I was never in the position Jesus is in of, oh, you know, if I have a bad day, I've got a real problem. Having said that, you know, I think the job, in my experience, you earn about after expenses what you would have made working at a Chipotle or something like that. And I think the studies people have done agree with that. And so for a lot of people, working at Chipotle is a better job than driving for Uber. And for other people, driving for Uber is a much better job than working at Chipotle or a similar type of restaurant. And so, you know, it's definitely a tough way to make a living, and you're not going to get rich doing it. But for some people, it's a much better option, or at least a somewhat better option than their alternative.
I don't know what Chipotle pays. I assume entry level's minimum wage or not much above that.
Yeah, a little bit more. I mean, you can look, and again, I've done research within Uber. You can look across cities, and the Uber drivers make about minimum wage or a little bit more in lower income cities, but in San Francisco, even after expenses, they're making, you know, $13, $15, $18 an hour, depending on who the person is and what their expenses are, what type of car they're driving and so forth. So it's a little more than minimum wage, but, you know, like I said, it's not a ton of money.
What's your sense if the added benefits that come from employee status legally have to be conferred to drivers, you know, what's your sense of how much that would improve the quality of life of drivers and how much that might affect the company?
Well, it's a really interesting question because what one thing that's kind of vague from the San Francisco Chronicle op-ed piece that the executives at Lyft and Uber wrote is exactly who would pay what into the benefits that are being proposed. So there was some talk of minimum of guaranteeing a base wage of some sort and other types of enabling them to get other benefits, healthcare, and various other types of flexible benefits. And it wasn't as clear how much Lyft and Uber are going to put into that beyond what they're putting in now. So it clearly makes sense for Uber and Lyft to take on the fixed costs of setting up benefits programs for their drivers. But then the question is, in a lot of, as you know from many other jobs, people pay their own healthcare costs often, even if the firm sets it up. So the answer to your question is the devil is in the details, and it's a little bit vague at this point exactly what will happen if Uber does go ahead and provide some of the benefits they talked about in that piece.
Professor Sundarajan of NYU, do you think ultimately this could lead to the revival of taxi companies?
I don't actually think so. I think, you know, any form of on-demand transportation, you know, is going to resemble Uber and Lyft in the future. If we do see a different sort of set of people facilitating these rides, you know, the mobile phone or whatever device people are using in the future will certainly be the channel. But just to sort of go back to the points that you and Paul were making a few minutes ago, I think the who pays for these benefits and how do we decouple the employer as the primary sort of funder of benefits, I think, is the central question here. I mean, I'm sure that there are many drivers like Jesus who want to be employees, but most of the drivers I've spoke to who want to be employees, if you drill down a little further, you'll find that they don't really want the employee-work arrangement. They want the nice things that are exclusively tied to full-time employment today, the insurance, the benefits, and the protections. And, you know, I've always been struck by the fact that Uber and Lyft have spent billions of dollars competing for drivers, like these massive driver incentives. Neither of them has had the freedom to compete for drivers by offering benefits. And, you know, you look at other workers in the United States, sure, the government mandates stuff, but, you know, as was pointed out, I mean, a lot of times it's labor market competition that is generating things like paid vacations, better health insurance, like, you know, better work insurance. So I think what John Zimmer and Logan Green and Dara Khosrowshahi are proposing is sort of this holy grail of portable benefits for the sharing economy, and it's been that way for a while, some sort of safe harbor in which the platforms can prove that if they are given some sort of protection against employee class action lawsuits, sort of like, you know, worker classification lawsuits, that the market will respond and actually start to provide both funding models and actual funding for some of these benefits. I mean, it makes no sense to me to try and stuff tomorrow's workforce into this either full-time employee or independent contractor bucket. You know, the workforce of the future is largely going to be somewhere on this continuum rather than fitting neatly into one of these two categories. So we need to come up with funding structures that allow sort of greater fluidity for the individual, the institution, and the government to sort of play a role. And I'm hoping that, you know, this carve out for Uber and Lyft following Dynamics is going to be a first step towards that. Because it's not just Uber and Lyft drivers who are going to be in this position in a decade, it's going to be accountants, it's going to be consultants, it's going to be lawyers, maybe even professors, who have these sort of fluid relationships with an institution rather than being full-time employees.
Professor Arun Sundarajan, NYU, thank you, sir, for being with us. He's professor of entrepreneurship and tech at NYU and author of the book The Sharing Economy. And our thanks to Stanford University professor of economics, Paul Oyer, who actually went to work as an Uber driver to better understand the driver relationship with the company. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, the Democratic National Committee has selected the two pools of 10 candidates each for the first two nights of the Democratic candidates' debates week after next. We'll hear how they're aligned in 1 minute. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Film Week coming right up in just a few minutes. In fact, I see the talent has entered the green room. Our critics are on the scene. Justin Chang, Amy Nicholson, Charles Solomon. And we'll hear their reviews of Shaft, Samuel L. Jackson, Jesse T. Usher, and the original Shaft, Richard Roundtree, in the cast. Also, Men in Black International. And we'll hear about the documentary Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese. Also want to take a moment to thank our wonderful Air Talk production team, the best in the business. Huge talent and huge heart, led by Fiona Ng, our senior producer. Our producer, Natalie Chudnovsky, helped this week from Caitlin Plummer and Jonaki Mehta. Our news apprentices, Matt Bynum and Ari Saperstein, and our engineer, Parker McDaniels. Also, just a quick note, I'm going to be off for some vacation. Kyle Stokes and Libby Denkman are going to be hosting in my stead while I'm gone. Then I look forward to be back with you after my trip. We turn our attention now, though, to the announcement from NBC this morning that the Democratic National Committee has not only chosen who the 20 candidates are that'll be part of the two-night first debate series, but also how the candidates will be grouped 10 and 10. With us to talk about it from Politico's Morning Score newsletter, campaign reporter Zach Montalero. Zach, thanks for joining us. First of all, how did the separation of the candidates take place?
Hey, Larry, thanks for having me back. So the separation took place this morning. The DNC and NBC, the network hosting the debate, held a random drawing, basically. And they took the top-tier candidates polling above 2%, and split them across randomly across the two nights, June 26th and June 27th. They took the bottom-tier candidates polling below 2%, and split them across the nights as well. And then the network decided which lineup will go on which night.
All right. And we should just back up a moment because we learned, I think it was yesterday, that Montana Governor Steve Bullock, who was one of the last declared candidates, Congressmember Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, they are not included, nor Senator Mike Gravel of Alaska, and also the mayor of Miramar, Florida, Wayne Messam. So they're excluded altogether. So let's take a look at the first night, June 26th, Wednesday night. Who's in the pool of 10 that night?
Sure. So the pool of 10 for June 26th, the first night, the big four candidates, the candidates polling above 2%, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke, and Elizabeth Warren. Then joining them, John Delaney, Bill de Blasio, Tulsi Gabbard, Jay Inslee, and Tim Ryan.
Okay, so they're in the first night, and what do we know about the allotment of time? Is everybody going to get the same amount, or are the moderators going to be focusing more on those that poll higher?
Yeah, so it'll be about the same amount of time for every candidate. The whole purpose of this process to randomize the stage, basically, was to ensure that no candidate gets preferential treatment one night or the other. And, you know, the network has not announced that so-and-so is going to get more questions than another, or so-and-so is going to get less questions. But, you know, knowing how the DNC has tried to protect this process and make it seem all very straightforward, every candidate has an equal shot, everyone should have just about the same amount of time.
All right. Now, for the second night, Thursday, June 27th, and again, it'll be televised on NBC and MSNBC and Telemundo, right? Spanish language as well?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. There, the top polling candidates, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, and Pete Buttigieg. That should be a very interesting debate.
Yeah, that's really the you know, heavy hitters all happened to land on that night. It was random. It was totally random. There was, you know, the eight top polling candidates were divided randomly. And I can't say random enough because they really, really leaned into that process. And it just so happened that four of the top five polling candidates, you know, the ones who have really distinguished themselves and have really broken out from the pack, they're on the night of June 27th. The only one who is not in the top five, the only one who is in the top five, rather, who is not on that night is Elizabeth Warren. She has that whole first night basically to herself among, you know, candidates who have broken out of the pack, candidates who are polling routinely above 5%, above 7%, sometimes in double digits nationally. The second night, it's got those four big hitters, Joe Biden leading the pack, Bernie Sanders right on his tail, you know, Kamala Harris, she's faltered a little bit in polls, but still a very strong candidate, and Pete Buttigieg, the surprise of the cycle so far, the candidate who's broken out the most. They're all there on the same night on June 27th.
Well, and in addition, a lesser polling candidate, John Hickenlooper, who just weekend before last at the California Democratic Party convention came out and said that, you know, essentially a socialist candidate is bad news for the party. He's the same night as Bernie Sanders. So that should be kind of fun.
Yeah, and earlier this week, actually, John Hickenlooper gave a speech here in Washington, you know, distinguishing himself from Bernie Sanders, basically explicitly going after Bernie Sanders' ideology, and that caused a tit-for-tat between Bernie Sanders and John Hickenlooper, both on Twitter and in the media. So those two will probably go after each other, too. Two other candidates I'm probably watching on that night on June 27th, Kirsten Gillibrand. She's, you know, cuts a very good profile for a presidential candidate. She's been lagging towards the back of the pack, but she's a very strong politician. She's a strong politician. And Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang is a little-known entrepreneur who's kind of come out of nowhere and has had a fairly successful campaign, all things considered. He's gotten a lot of donors. He's been polling pretty consistently at 1%, which is a lot more than a lot of other candidates can say. So he could have a moment, too. He's someone to watch.
All right. And again, back to that first night, it's going to be interesting to see Elizabeth Warren, who's become quite a dynamic figure on the campaign trail, and Cory Booker, of course, an extremely strong speaker, to see those two go head-to-head.
Yeah, you know, Cory Booker has not really – his campaign never really got off the launching pad. You know, he had a big announcement. He had got a lot of attention. And from there, he's kind of been hanging in the back. But Cory Booker is a strong candidate. There's been reasons that people have been saying for literally years that he could be a future president. He's an incredibly dynamic candidate. You know, he'll be up on stage. It'll be his time to shine. It'll be his first, you know, he'll get another round in the national spotlight again, which he very sorely needs. And he'll be able to go against the, you know, he'll be able to talk to Elizabeth Warren, someone he doesn't ideologically agree with, and try to distinguish himself. You know, is it good or is it bad that there's only one star candidate, and I use that term loosely, on the first night? I guess we'll see.
All right. Hey, thanks so much, Zach. Good to talk with you. Appreciate your talking about the announcement of the two-night lineups, which we got just about an hour ago. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Larry.
From Politico, the Morning Score newsletter author and campaign reporter Zach Montalero, talking with us about the lineups of Democratic presidential candidates, June 26th and 27th, NBC, MSNBC, and Telemundo with Spanish translation. That's going to be the first two nights in Miami of these Democratic candidates' debates. Coming up on Film Week, it's a very big weekend in movies. Got a lot of major titles from the studios. We'll tell you all about them coming right up. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Justin Chang of the Los Angeles Times, Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom, and Charles Solomon, film critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We begin with Men in Black International, directed by F. Gary Gray, screenplay from Art Markham and Matt Holloway. This is a continuation, of course, of the Men in Black franchise, two secret agents, played in this case by Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson, become involved in a series of alien attacks sending them around the globe.
We are a rumor, recognizable only as deja vu and dismissed just as quickly. We are the best kept secret in the universe.
I know. I want in. I found you, which makes me perfect for this job.
Men in Black International. Amy, what'd you think?
You know, this is just a good quality second base blockbuster summer picture. I really laughed a lot in this. Forgot it almost as soon as it was over, but it's very cannily done, very big, bold, funny. This is a blockbuster that has almost nothing to do with the original trilogy. You see a painting of Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones in an office, and that's about the extent of the references. But it's got the touchstones. It's got the black suits. It's got the neuralizers. And then the rest of it is kind of cobbled together from spare parts of what works very, very well in other franchises. You've got Tessa Thompson and Chris Hemsworth from Thor being plugged in here as the leads and having a really great chemistry. You've got the villainess from Mission Impossible here being the villainess in this one. And I laughed a lot, to be honest. It has kind of that light, almost erotic humor in moments that you're surprised to see in a blockbuster again, where it makes you feel like, thank you. Can we make dumb movies for grown-ups that don't have to be about the fate of the world is in our hands?
Men in Black International, Justin.
Yeah, I wish I'd laughed more at this, although, yeah, I think the erotic moment you were referring to, perhaps when Chris Hemsworth wakes up from a one-night stand with some and has tentacle marks across his bulging torso,
which,
you know.
Torso.
How is that sentence going to end? You know, and I think that Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson, who, of course, appeared together in Thor Ragnarok and the Last Avengers movie, have a lot of charm, and especially Tessa Thompson, who I think is the best thing in the movie by far. Again, that is something that is very derivative about this movie. You do feel with everything that happens, it is a somewhat inferior repetition of something that you've seen before done better. And so I like the two of them together. I think his character is kind of a pill because he's this, you know, golden boy agent who's gone to seed and drinks too much and, you know, is, you know, kind of can't get his head in the game. And she is the eager to please young recruit who's very by the book and very hyper competent. And it's about the cynical mentor training the new girl. And I liked them a lot. I just wish that they were in something that was a little bit more interesting. I think Emma Thompson is another bright spot, and she's the only real link, I think, to the previous Men in Black 3 or even any of the other Men in Black movies.
Men in Black International, F. Gary Gray, the director, Tessa Thompson, Chris Hemsworth star, rated PG-13 in wide release. Shaft is back, Samuel L. Jackson, Jesse T. Usher, and the original Shaft, of course, Richard Roundtree, Regina Hall in the cast, Tim Story directs, and Kenya Barris, Alex Barno are the screenwriters. Justin?
This is a very strange movie. And I think it's worth starting off by saying, you know, Shaft is now the longest running black series character in American movies. But it's interesting because these movies are all very self-enclosed, and despite having the same, you know, Roundtree's been in all of them, he played Shaft's dad in the 2000 John Singleton one, and here he's back as his uncle. So not a ton of inter-series continuity.
Is there any reveal that explains that?
No, it's very slapdash, which is totally fine. But the weirdest thing about this is that they've basically taken one of the coolest, suavest characters in movie history and cast him in this multi-generational, grumpy old dad sitcom. Because he has this son who's played by Jesse T. Usher, who's the third generation of John Shaft, who he abandoned along with his mom, who's played by Regina Hall. Always lovely to see Regina Hall. And the kid is now an FBI data analyst, and so he's working for the man. And so when he finally reunites with Shaft, you know, he gives him a lot of grief for working for the man and dressing nicely. And so he gets to kind of mouth off about millennials and metrosexuals and political correctness. All this chained to this just nonsense of a plot. It's like, so I guess this is the filmmaker's way of trying to make this movie relevant. And that's an interesting question. Like, why make a Shaft movie now when the character...
Because he's so cool.
He's so cool. True.
Isn't that really the reason for Shaft to exist?
But he's a complicated man.
I mean, here's the thing. When you make a Shaft movie in 2019, you have to acknowledge that Shaft is not cool, which to me is the most interesting thing that this film does, is you have Shaft, this absent father, mailing young Shaft. There's three Shafts. It's just multiple Shafts all over the place. And you're mailing his young son X-rated magazines. And this is a movie where the kid and his mom have to give each other an eye roll. Isn't dad lame for this? This is so retrograde. And so in those moments, I kind of found myself enjoying it for making fun of what the Shaft character looks like today. He looks like something where the coat must smell
like
mothballs.
See, and I can't envision original Shaft, my Shaft of my my boyhood. I can't picture him doing that kind of stuff.
Mailing X-rated magazines?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not character consistent to me.
I can't believe this franchise has no consistency. What is happening?
I'm shocked. Shocked.
I mean, this movie is so inconsistent, even on the inside, that it's basically just giant gunfight after giant gunfight, each one capped by the young boy saying, "I hate guns," as he grabs another gun and proceeds to blow 70 holes in the next person. What are you going to do with this movie?
But again, these actors are appealing to watch. Just not, and it's an interesting idea executed very sloppily.
I really loved Jesse T. Usher, who played Young Shaft. This is the first time I've seen him in anything, and I really loved him.
All right, we're talking about Shaft. Samuel L. Jackson. I didn't intend for that. Jesse T. Usher.
Sure you didn't.
That's totally unconscious. Richard Roundtree, the original Shaft. It's rated R in wide release. Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese, a documentary which is on the big screen as well as streaming on Netflix. What'd you think, Justin?
Well, the subtitle alone, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese, should tell you this movie is meant to be taken with a massive pillar of salt. Some have described it as a documentary. It's actually a very slippery weave of fact and fiction. In that respect, it's very different from Scorsese's previous Dylan documentaries, The Last Waltz and No Direction Home. This covers the 1975 Rolling Thunder tour that Dylan mounted with friends and fellow artists, including Allen Ginsberg and Joan Baez, Sam Shepard, Ramblin' Jack Elliott. They came together, you know, when the country was still reeling from Vietnam and Watergate, and Dylan imagined this incredible tour as a kind of magical return to the mythologies of America's past. As he envisioned it as like a traveling circus or medicine show. And so in a lot of the concert footage, which is absolutely glorious, you'll see Dylan performing something like A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall or A Simple Twist of Fate wearing white face paint. And at a certain point, he says, "You only tell the truth when you're wearing a mask." And the movie basically takes that line as its entire conceit in terms of making you second guess what is real in this movie and what is not. He early on says, Bob Dylan says he doesn't remember anything about Rolling Thunder. It happened before I was born, which is, of course, a complete lie. But that's kind of your cue to not take this not seriously, but not necessarily factually. There are talking heads in the movie who are treated like documentary subjects, but as you're watching them, you realize that they're, in fact, fictional. The footage of the tour itself and the performances exist because Dylan had a camera crew to shoot his 1978 art film, Rinaldo and Clara. But here it's credited to a filmmaker who is completely fictional. So Scorsese and Dylan are being incredibly playful here. And, you know, hardcore Dylanologists, of whom I am not one, will probably have a field day dissecting this, picking it apart, and maybe, you know, poking, you know, getting angry about some of the liberties. But it's all very Dylan-esque because Dylan, of course, is the most slippery of popular entertainers when it comes to identity. And as a, you know, and he's a spinner of tall tales, and that is very much the essence in the heart of this movie.
Is it almost like Bob Dylan with Spinal Tap? I mean,
there is very much a Christopher Guest kind of element to some of it, but it's also done, you know, a little more seamlessly than that, or seamless in the sense of like it doesn't cue you in quite. It's a very gradual, I'm watching this and Sharon Stone is in this movie, and oh, I didn't know Sharon Stone was part of the tour. Wait, was she on the tour? Wait, what? What's the story she's telling? But it really feeds into this idea of the way in which myths become made and printing the legend, you know, so it works really well, I think.
Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese. You can see it on the big screen at the Vintage Los Feliz as well as Lemley's Monica Film Center. It's also streaming on Netflix. The film is unrated. Funan is a French animated feature which stars Bérénice Bejo. You remember her, of course, from The Artist. Denis Doe is the director and also the co-screenwriter. Charles, what did you think of Funan?
Well, this is a very interesting film, very different from what we think of as animation. It is not some glorious fairy tale with musical numbers. It's based on Doe's family story about how his relatives escaped from the Khmer Rouge when Pol Pot and his thugs took over in Cambodia. It's primarily his mother's story, and he said he wanted to do it in animation as he felt the animated figure would be truer to her and a more universal figure than a live actress would be. The family is taken away from their homes, and as they're being herded along, the mother and her husband are separated from their young son, and she spends the next several years desperately trying to find out what's become of him. He's been sent to a re-education camp to make him a good little revolutionary.
He's just four, right?
Thereabouts, yeah. And it's several years, so he's absent from his parents during those crucial years. They finally are reunited and are able to escape to freedom. It's very moving. It's very minimal. It's drawn animation, drawn on Wacom tablets, I assume. Handsomely colored, but a dark, serious, brooding kind of film. I would not be surprised if it got an Oscar nomination, as there for several years now we've had the more artistic, individual kinds of films like the Cartoon Saloon films or My Life as a Zucchini, you know, getting some representation in that category. And as so many of the big studio animated films this year have been disappointments, this is a very strong, very powerful film, not for children, not something that's going to send you out, you know, with a spring in your step and a song in your heart, but a reminder of just how powerful animation can be in presenting a message that might be too grim or too difficult to do in live action.
We're talking about the animated feature Funan from director Denis Doe, who co-wrote the screenplay. The film is unrated, but as you just heard Charles say, it is for adult audiences, not for kids. You can see it at the Lemley Glendale Cinemas. Again, the film is unrated. The Palestinian movie The Reports on Sarah and Salim is directed by Muigad Anlayan. Justin, what do you think of this film?
I thought this was a very tense and engrossing and well-acted movie. It's set in present-day Jerusalem, and it explores what happens when an illicit love affair crosses social and political lines. It's the second feature by Palestinian director Muayyad Alayan, and it tells the story of a Palestinian man named Salim, who's played by Adib Safari, who becomes involved with an Israeli woman named Sarah. She's played by Savine Kretschner. There are class distinctions here. Salim is a poor delivery man who has a pregnant wife at home, while Sarah owns a cafe and has a daughter with her husband, who's a rising figure in the Israeli army, and his job is investigating terrorist activity. So the movie's about how a kind of James M. Cain-like situation like this, but because of the setting and because of the milieu, the personal is incredibly political. Sarah and Salim are spotted together one night in Bethlehem. And from that single tragic accident, events spiral out of control in ways that no one could anticipate. And so this is a domestic melodrama that is also very much a critique of the Israeli-Palestinian crisis and especially the occupation, the way the police detain Salim and basically turn him into a scapegoat and accuse him of being a terrorist, which he is not. And then they accuse him of trying to seduce this Israeli woman onto his side. It's very even-handed and sympathetic to all of its characters, and it's a sad look at how an impossible situation becomes even more impossible.
And strong performances.
Very, very well acted by everyone.
The Reports on Sarah and Salim, unrated. It's at Lemley's Theaters, the Royal West LA, Playhouse Pasadena, Town Center, and Encino. And the screenplay written by the director's brother, Rami Musa Alayan. We have many more films to come. We're back in just 1 minute on Film Week. Always a pleasure to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Charles Solomon, Amy Nicholson, and Justin Chang. Next up, The Dead Don't Die, a horror fantasy comedy from writer-director Jim Jarmusch. Stars Bill Murray, Adam Driver, Tilda Swinton, Chloe Sevigny, and many, many more in the ensemble cast. Amy, what'd you think of The Dead Don't Die?
Yeah, this is a strange little film that I've been thinking about a lot, you know, because it comes on like a giant, strange slapstick comedy, which you're like, oh, okay, Jim Jarmusch, I'm interested in this, with Bill Murray and Adam Driver driving around as the local cops of the small town called Centerville as the zombie horde approaches. There's very, very heavy nods to Romero, to everybody who's like obsessed with the zombie genre. All of that stuff is in here. And then as the film progresses, it gets stranger and stranger. And I walked away being like, oh, wow, this is the angriest movie I've seen all year. This is Jim Jarmusch putting a very strong environmentalist stance in the middle of a zombie movie, kind of like layering and underneath. Because, you know, a zombie movie is always about something else. Like, what are the zombies representing here? And here, it really nails this feeling of facing a horde of zombies is like facing the collapse of the planet. It's like facing climate change. It's like, what do you do when there's a giant problem that you alone probably can't solve? Because most zombie movies end badly. And so this is a movie that is... I can see it being very hit or miss for people, but I walked away like kind of just thinking about it over and over and over again.
It doesn't sound particularly comedic, but it is funny too.
I can't. It's hard for me to imagine it's trying to be funny. What
do
you think?
Yeah, it is, but the laughs in typical Jarmuschian fashion, I think, are sort of doled out at this very leisurely pace. I admire this movie, and I wanted to like it more in the moment. I have also been thinking about it a lot. I love Jarmusch's films, and I especially love his previous genre experiment, the vampire movie Only Lovers Left Alive, which is so great. Here, he's made what you might call an undeadpan comedy.
Oh,
come on. You've been saving
that up. It's a gimme. Come on, guys. So it's very droll, but very bleak at the same time. And there are these very obvious political signifiers that Amy mentions, like Steve Buscemi plays the town bigot who wears this red cap that says, "Keep America White Again." It's like, that's literally what it says.
So.
And the zombie epidemic is blamed on rampant polar fracking, which has thrown the Earth off balance, and now the sun doesn't set, or it sets at the wrong time. And what Jarmusch is basically saying is that we are this nation of zombies. We're lazy, and we're inattentive, and we're doomed, and the planet is dying no matter how much we try to fight back. And so you're not, but the result is that the movie feels like a shrug. And you could say that that's a good thing. I guess it's a fitting thing because that's his attitude toward it. But it also feels a little, maybe like it's lacking in a certain urgency that I wanted. So it's an interesting, though, you know, we've seen a lot of revisionist genre riffs and things, too. It's not like this is the first iteration of this kind of thing. But it is interesting, given Jarmusch's sensibility.
Jim Jarmusch's film, The Dead Don't Die, Jarmusch, the writer, director, Bill Murray and Adam Driver star with Tilda Swinton and Chloe Sevigny. It's rated R in select theaters. Murder Mystery, an action mystery comedy, starring Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston. Kyle Nowacek, the director, and James Vanderbilt wrote the screenplay. Amy.
Yeah, I find Murder Mystery, this movie, fascinating for a couple reasons. Because, you know, in 2011, you have Jennifer Aniston and Adam Sandler pairing together for like a caper movie abroad called Just Go With It, which makes like $200 million at the box office. And now we have a movie not that different, but it exists on Netflix, which is sort of a fine place for a lazy-ish, sort of charming, I don't know, film like this. The plot here is that Adam Sandler is a cop, a very bad husband, who finally, after 10 years of being married to Jennifer Aniston, is strong-armed into taking her to Europe for the first time. And she meets a rich man on the plane, played by Luke Evans, doing his kind of dastardly villain thing that he's very good at, and he's very good at it here. He invites them onto a yacht owned by his uncle, who owns a $70 billion fortune. And of course, the uncle gets stabbed before they get to eat dinner. And this movie, I suppose, is an indictment of the French cops who immediately assume that Aniston and Sandler are to blame. And of course, hijinks ensue, giant car crash, everything you're expecting. And yet, you know, it's very knowingly Agatha Christie goofy, I guess. You've got Gemma Arterton as an actress on the ship. There's a race car driver and a Maharaja. You know, there's everybody. There's a colonel with one eye. And, you know,
tons of people. It's like a seagoing Orient Express.
It is. In fact, it makes a very deliberate nod to that toward the end. I mean, I don't have a ton of patience for the Adam Sandler shtick where he walks into a movie and he's like, "I'm lazy and I don't like to try and I'm terrible, but I'll show you that by the end of this movie, I'll be proven to be the smartest man on this boat." And you're like, oh, God. But Jennifer Aniston, I thought, was actually really great. I found myself rewatching some of her scenes because she's giving an actual performance in a movie that you're like, you didn't have to do this.
Murder Mystery, Justin.
Jennifer Aniston is so consistently great, I think, in a lot of comedies that really let her down because the material just, again, is not very funny. It's a weird script by James Vanderbilt, whose best credit by far is Zodiac, you know, the mother of true crime police procedurals, and clearly a talented writer, knows his way around a plot. And the things that I liked best about this movie, it's weird too. I am actually very much the target audience for this because I kind of love
you're
old school.
You're an Adam Sandler fan?
No. Not
Number
an
Adam Sandler fan over here.
I am an up and down appreciator of sometimes the when Adam Sandler makes a good movie every decade or so. But I love old school detective novels, and I love the kind of I kind of like the idea as well, Amy, that Netflix is now investing in the kinds of movies that Hollywood used to crank out by the dozen. These very geeky, creaky, puzzle solving, you know, body in a library type of thing. And yet, so I was sort of grooving on some of that, but it's not a painful movie. It's very pleasant. The locations look great. They're in Monte Carlo. They're in Lake Como. They're in Malaga. But I just, you know, Sandler, who I sometimes find very hard to take, is actually perfectly fine, I think, doing, again, very familiar shtick. It's just not very funny in the end.
Murder Mystery is streaming on Netflix. It's rated PG-13. 5B, a documentary about the AIDS ward of San Francisco General Hospital. The film was directed by Dan Krause and Paul Haggis. Charles?
Well, this is depressing and infuriating and necessary. Ward 5B was the first facility dedicated to care of AIDS patients before the name AIDS had been coined, before the HIV virus had been identified. And many caregivers were terrified, not knowing what to do with these patients. They couldn't cure them. They were afraid to go near them in some cases. And apparently some of the nurses and caregivers at this hospital were shooting footage that they've saved all this time. And one of the things that they did that upset a lot of the medical establishment was they would touch the patients. There's a heartbreaking scene where a man says to the nurse, "No one's touched me in a year." Mm-hmm. And you also see infuriating things like Ronald Reagan finally using the term AIDS after 27,000 citizens of the country he's supposed to preside over have died. So it's infuriating when you see the bigotry and the ignorance and the hatred that these people had to find. And you end up just wanting to give some awards to these caregivers who help the least of us.
How's the filmmaking aside from...
Skillful. No, I mean, they found a lot of old footage, and they found these same nurses and caregivers who are remembering and talking. And it ties it all together in a very moving package. You know, my voice is breaking thinking about some of the moments in this film. So it's very, very effective, but again, not a cheery film.
Powerful documentary, 5B. It's rated PG-13 in select theaters. The drama American Woman stars Sienna Miller, Christina Hendricks, and Aaron Paul. Jake Scott directs from Brad Ingleby's script. Amy?
I will lay my cards at the start of this review. I think Sienna Miller is our greatest underappreciated actress, and this movie is another tribute to that. I mean, what this film is about is Sienna Miller plays a woman who's in her early 30s at the start, and it's a character study of her growing up as an adult. You know, she was a teen mom who then had a teenage daughter who was a teen mom herself. And so in the very beginning of the movie, her young daughter disappears and leaves her with the boy and never comes back. And so you watch her deal with this loss over years and years and years in this small town where she lives literally across the street from her sister, Christina Hendricks, who gives a lot of unwanted advice, but also help. You know, they have a very good, complex, and I think credible sisterly relationship. And really, this film is just about watching Sienna Miller go through so many changes, try to get her life on order, go from a drunken party girl to something sort of mature. And she makes a lot of mistakes. She makes a lot of mistakes along the way. She gets married to a patriarchal creep played by Pat Healy. But you care so much about her. You really just love this woman. And I was knocked out absolutely by this performance. Like, you want to reach into the screen and just grab Sienna Miller and be like, "You are such a screw up and I want things to be okay for you."
American Woman, starring Sienna Miller. It's rated R at Lemley's Playhouse Pasadena and the AMC in Century City. The documentary from Brazil, The Edge of Democracy, is directed by Petra Costa. The film is unrated. Justin?
Yeah, this works very well, I think, as both a primer on the tumultuous last several years of Brazilian politics and also as a very passionate personal essay film. It covers the period starting with the rise of former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and his succession by President Dilma Rousseff, both from the country's Workers' Party, Today, of course, Lula is in prison, having been convicted of corruption and money laundering, and Rousseff was impeached, and far-right President Jair Bolsonaro is in power. The documentary will resonate with anyone who is noticing and who is alarmed by the rise of right-wing nationalism all over the world, whether it's the Trump administration or Brexit or many countries in Europe. It's especially poignant here because, as the title suggests, Brazilian democracy was such a new and fragile and seemingly short-lived concept. This is a country that endured years of brutal military dictatorship and that imported slaves from Africa, and it didn't embrace democracy until the 80s. And Petra Costa, the filmmaker, points out that she and Brazilian democracy are kind of the same age, and her parents were both liberal activists who were exiled and imprisoned at different points. And so when candidates like Lula came along, Lula was working class and he was leader of a steelworkers union, it really felt like a dream come true for them and other people. So it's very fiery, very vital stuff. It's about the way nuance is lost when populist politics and a mob mentality takes over. It's pretty gripping.
It's going to be on screen at Lemley's Monica Film Center next Wednesday, June 19th, and it's streaming on Netflix, The Edge of Democracy, unrated. The Raft is the story of an anthropological experiment from 1973. It's a documentary with footage from the experiment. It's directed by Marcus Lindeen. Amy.
This documentary is fascinating. So what happened is in 1973, there was a social anthropologist who worked out of Mexico. He was on a plane and the plane got hijacked. And it made him think, I need to study the origins of anger and of human aggression. So his strategy, because this is the 70s and we're learning how to do experiments, is he built a raft and he put 13 people on it. Himself, a cameraman, and then seven women, I think, or slightly more women than men. And he did all of these things that he's very open about. We have his tapes. We have somebody reading his audio diaries. We have original footage of the ship saying that he did calculated things like everybody had to be hot, but everybody had to be married because he wanted to figure out when people are going to have tension with each other.
Sounds like reality TV.
It's a lot like reality TV. And what he finds out really surprised him. And so then he starts messing with the experiment. And when he starts messing with the experiment, this film got really dark and really fascinating. And what they've done here to make it seem visual, even in the present, is beyond the documentary footage, they've rebuilt the raft to scale out of wood. And all the survivors are now on the raft as older people walking around, living through their memories, being like, you slept here, I slept here. Do you remember when we talked about killing someone? And it's really worth a watch.
The Raft, the documentary from director Marcus Lindeen at Lemley's Glendale Cinema. The film is unrated. Coming up, we'll hear from Justin about the Locarno Film Festival in Los Angeles. And we'll also talk about the blockbusters that never were, big budget movies that were total duds. We'll talk about that as we continue right after this. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Before we talk about Dark Phoenix, the X-Men movie that bombed and its projected huge losses and where that fits with other bombs, we do want to talk about a film that Justin Chang has alerted us to in the past, a 14.5-hour Argentinian epic, La Flor.
Yes, this is playing, starts tonight. Get your tickets now.
all in one sitting?
Not in one sitting, although that would be most conversations about this movie start with the extreme length. But of course, 14.5 hours is nothing in the binging era. Think about it as the new Netflix 10-parter that just dropped. You know, so in your living room, yeah. It's playing at the Lemley Music Hall over the next 3 days. It is a commitment. I went through it myself, and I am a richer person for it. This is a film from the Argentinian director Mariano Ginas, and it's playing as part of the Locarno in Los Angeles festival, which is basically the Locarno Film Festival is held every fall, and this is a selection of highlights from that festival, films receiving their LA premieres. This La Flor is, I'll be brief, even though the movie is not. It's six episodes. Five of the six feature the same quartet of lead actresses, and it is basically a fantasia on cinema. They're playing different roles throughout. Part one is a mummy horror sci-fi film. Part two is this musical melodrama. Part three is a 5.5-hour spy thriller in which all four of them play assassins and you get to know each one's backstory. Found it completely riveting. And then part four and five and six just get increasingly weird and meta. It's a hoot. It's an intellectual feast. It's great storytelling and it's about storytelling. And I don't think you should miss it if you love movies and you live in LA.
La Flor, the Argentinian epic at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills as a part of the Locarno in LA Film Festival. Well, Dark Phoenix, as I was mentioning, an X-Men film that completely bombed. Our critics warned you about the movie and apparently people heeded that warning. With us to talk about where Dark Phoenix sits compared to other big-budget bombs of the past, Sean Fennessy, editor-in-chief, chief content officer at the sports and pop culture website The Ringer. He also is the host of the Big Picture podcast. Sean, thank you for joining us.
Larry, it's my pleasure.
So what went wrong with Dark Phoenix?
Ooh, where to begin? Virtually everything. I suppose it starts back in 2000 when there was an X-Men movie, but we find ourselves almost 20 years later at the conclusion, theoretically, of this saga. And the film is what feels like many films Frankenstein together. And as you guys talked about last week, this movie does not work, and critics know that it does not work. But more so, I think fans know that it doesn't work. And it's the victim of a series of complex industry and creative problems. We've got a movie that is at the mercy of a merger between Fox and Disney. We've got a movie that has been shot and then reshot and then reshot once more. We've got a movie that has changed character names, alien races that have been redefined midstream. We've just got a series of quagmires throughout the production of the film, and I think audiences smelled it a long ways away.
So I've seen that the estimate is it could lose $100 to $120 million.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing to, I think, try to understand. As all of you guys know, the way we receive information about what the budget of a film is a bit opaque. So sometimes we hear a movie cost $150 million. What does that mean? Does that mean every single dollar was spent on the making of the movie? Sometimes. It depends on how the studio delivers that information to us. Sometimes there's the marketing budget, which can exceed $30, $40, $50 million for certain films. So how much information we have publicly makes it hard to understand, did this movie lose $100 million? Did it lose $150 million? We'll never actually know the truth of that number, but Dark Phoenix has been reported to have cost $200 million. It has already made worldwide $145 million. That seems not so bad. But all of those hidden costs that we're not talking about, that we don't understand, make this seem like a bigger failure.
So, Amy Nicholson, do you have nominations for biggest bombs of all time?
Is it wrong to start off by saying that I kind of am fascinated by bombs as a whole? Because
yeah,
to me, what a bomb is, great, then I'm right in my zone. Because what I think is so fascinating about is a bomb, and what kind of draws me to film in general as an anthropologist, is a giant studio movie like Dark Phoenix is saying, we think we know what the American people want. I have a gamble on what's in the zeitgeist. I have a feeling about what they're willing to spend their money on. And when they're wrong, it's fascinating because it's kind of a snapshot of what we care about as audiences. Which is why, as a critic, I've always been as interested in blockbuster films as indie films. And so with that in mind, like, I'm excited that superhero movies are bombing. Is that okay? Can I just say that out loud?
Totally. Sure.
Yes. You won't get an argument.
It was reassuring when Solo bombed last year because it's like, because when it was a terrible movie, and it was good to know that even Star Wars is not infallible.
All right.
Well, and remember, George Lucas also brought us Strange Magic.
I don't remember that, actually.
Yeah, lucky you.
Charles, you have any animated versions of bombs to share?
There was Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within, that had a built-in audience of tens of millions from the games. It was a complete bomb, took down the studio with it. Titan AE was another one that ended Fox Animation.
That's something. That's quite a credit to be so bad that you actually destroyed the studio that made it.
Yes. Lost something like $100 million and is one of the very worst films Don Bluth ever made.
Wow.
So, just saying something.
Well, and quickly along those lines, too, Heaven's Gate, you know, which, you know, the much maligned and for many grievously misunderstood Michael Cimino epic, which famously bankrupted United Artists.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, and so you say famously misunderstood. Some of the bombs have actually had a kind of renewed appreciation. That's one.
Heaven's Gate has absolutely undergone, I think, a critical reclamation. So has Ishtar.
We're in such an Elaine moment, an Elaine May moment, and I think Ishtar is finally getting its due, which is sort of nice to see.
Because that was always the film where it was theorized the people making it were having so much fun that it left the audience out and there was nothing left for the people watching it to enjoy. Sean, what do you stand out as some of the biggest bombs of all time?
Well, I guess the world historical classic is Cleopatra, the 1963 Liz Taylor adaptation, which is not a good film and also quite long, not quite as long as that 14-hour film.
It feels it.
It does. The thing that's interesting, though, and you mentioned Heaven's Gate, and I think you can point to The Cotton Club, the Francis Ford Coppola film. You can talk about Ishtar. You can talk about Bonfire of the Vanities. The thing that is different about some of those movies is there was a lot of journalism and attention paid on them, and I think the reclamation project is because we understand the arc of the failure. And now, with a lot of the movies that fail, you mentioned Solo. You know, you can think of a frivolous movie like R.I.P.D., which was a very bad Ryan Reynolds, Jeff Bridges movie that came out in 2013. No one saw that movie and no one cared. There was no journalism about why that movie failed. It just didn't work and it wasn't interesting. And the films in the 70s and 80s that tended to fail were part of a different kind of industry. Much of the movie industry now is owned by massive corporations. And so there is an expectation that they have to make a huge number. It's not personal. It's not a small business anymore. And when it was a smaller business, it felt more fun and more interesting to understand why Liz Taylor flopped so badly. And we're just in a different movie economy.
And is it harder to understand today international exhibition than in the past? I mean, particularly what, say, Chinese filmgoers are going to appreciate.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, we mentioned Dark Phoenix earlier. Dark Phoenix has made $140 million. $100 million has come internationally. That was just not a part of the calculus even 25 years ago. China wasn't showing American films in their theaters 12 years ago. So we find ourselves in an interesting moment for what is a flop. Solo made quite a bit of money, but did it make enough money? What is enough money? How do we legislate what is a success now?
And that's one reason for the popularity of the comic book type movies is that violence plays everywhere. There are different attitudes about romance or comedy in other parts of the world, but the good guy shooting the bad guy with 70 bullets, as Amy counted, that plays anywhere.
Well, you know, important to mention, too, in the case of Solo, I mean, this is not going to kill off Star Wars films. And Dark Phoenix, it's disastrous showing is not going to kill off Marvel films, certainly. So the genre is going to continue.
I think what's interesting about it is this might be the best thing that could have happened to X-Men. I think people forgetting that this was a version of X-Men is what Disney wants.
We'll continue with Sean Fennessy joining us from The Ringer, where he's editor-in-chief and chief content officer. He's the host of the Big Picture podcast as well, along with our Amy Nicholson, Justin Chang, and Charles Solomon. We'll talk about the biggest bombs in movie history as we continue on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics with us this week are Justin Chang, Charles Solomon, and Amy Nicholson, and also joining us for our conversation about the biggest bombs in film of all time, Sean Fennessy of The Ringer, the sports and pop culture website. You can also put your nomination for the biggest film bomb of all time on our Film Week page at kpcc.org. Sean, you have a list of bombs here beyond Cleopatra.
Should we talk about some more recent failures?
Yeah, let's do that.
There was a little bit of chatter about The Lone Ranger, Gore Verbinski's 2013 Johnny Depp adaptation.
That was painful.
Not a great success.
I would say it was an underappreciated film.
I would agree.
I think Armie Hammer really understood that character. What are you going to do with a gigantic, handsome man like Armie Hammer except make a joke out of how wonderful he is?
I agree. I tend to like the movie, and I think the reclamation of these movies is a fascinating thing that happens how they live on.
We have enough music. Movies with horses running across trains and buildings.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, like, to Sean's point about the conversations around the films of the 60s and 70s and what we have today. What we have today that I think can be more destructive is Twitter buzz, which just sort of starts. Like, it started around R.I.P.D. and it started around Lone Ranger, that it was going to be bad. before anybody ever really saw it. And that just solidifies for some reason into a fact before the movie comes out.
And troubled production often is read, oh, the film is going to be a mess. Mm-hmm. But that's not always the case. Sometimes, you know, films that you hear were difficult productions actually end up as gems.
You know, what's an interesting—
Ratatouille.
That's right. Yeah. That's an interesting version of that, too, is we talked about Solo. And Rogue One was another Star Wars film that came out a few years ago, which also had a very similarly troubled production. The director was replaced. It was rewritten halfway through. But we didn't know that before the movie came out. And so when we saw the film, we thought, oh, this must have been a rosy production. We knew the directors of Solo were fired halfway through the production of that film. So that does matter with how we perceive it.
And last year, the opposite case with Bohemian Rhapsody, a hugely troubled production that became a record-breaking, you know, like a smash.
That's
so
exactly right.
It doesn't, you know,
and we're all so happy about it.
And I think it doesn't matter if it's a great filmmaker making the movie. We saw the Wachowskis in 2008 made Speed Racer, which is a film that a lot of people admire to this day, but was a massive bomb, hugely failed. Well, I guess the color and the excitement and the verve aesthetics of that film.
But it was a movie about racing, and you had no idea where they were in the race.
It's true. It was experimental. Yeah. It's always hard to say what's not going to work. I think it was evident that like something like Battlefield Earth, though, was not going to work.
Battlefield Earth, the John Travolta film that was a real personal project for him from an L. Ron Hubbard story.
Yes, and I think the minute you saw the trailer, I think most people knew this is not for me. This doesn't look very good.
One of the biggest bombs from Guy Ritchie was King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. And again, you said sometimes opaque to get the financial information, but the estimate I'm looking at is $150 million loss from that film.
And sometimes it doesn't matter because Guy Ritchie immediately got a job and began to direct Aladdin for Disney. So sometimes it's not held against the filmmaker. You never can tell.
Maybe it should be.
But I do think it's interesting that sometimes the perception of a bomb is the truth, even when the numbers don't back it up. I mean, you guys know that I'm obsessed with Tom Cruise. And there's this idea that his career tanked in 2005, you know, the year of Oprah, when he jumped on the couch. But the Oprah jumping on the couch thing happened right before he opened War of the Worlds, which is actually his biggest hit. But if you ask anybody, that's the year his career died.
Who would guess that was his biggest hit?
His biggest box office hit. It was right when everybody said his career was over, and he ended up getting fired from Paramount that year. His production company had to leave the studio because there was this perception he was a flop, even though he'd never done better.
All right. Any other films, Justin, that you want to add to this list?
It's a Wonderful Life was perceived as a huge flop, barely recouping its budget when it grossed only $3.3 million when it opened. And it is now, of course, a holiday perennial. So.
Yeah, Casablanca was seen as a surefire bomb, and it happened one night. Claudette Colbert dismissed that when she finished it.
So a lot of these perceptions really are not necessarily true.
But I will say, to that point, you know, I do a podcast where we're going through the AFI Top 100. And over half of the films on that list were the number one film of that year, which I find to be a little depressing.
Wow, yeah.
The idea that box office clout really does define what films we remember. It's the outliers that are the films.
See,
like
I would
the
choose to
lives.
Look at the opposite. Well, maybe people's taste, the general public, is better than critics want to give it credit for. Yeah. Yeah, maybe it's sort of an anti-elitism.
Yeah, hey, Larry, try getting folks off the street to do this show.
Bill, we do have elite critics. Bill in the San Gabriel Valley wants to bring up the Disney film John Carter, which was a massive loser. And that one that was, you know, rather eagerly anticipated at some point.
It was
Andrew Stanton. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Before some, again, the behind-the-scenes news started coming out.
Yeah, and we think of Disney as this indestructible force, this train that cannot be stopped. But we're talking about John Carter. We're talking about Solo. We're talking about movies that they made that just did not work.
A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah, A Wrinkle in Time last year. And no one is impervious to this kind of failure.
Well, I remember when Eddie Murphy was riding high and, you know, his movie's doing so well, and then he does The Adventures of Pluto Nash, which lost nearly $100 million.
The Haunted Mansion didn't exactly burn up the box office either.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was after Beverly Hills Cop, Trading Places, Nutty Professor, terrific film, Dr. Doolittle. Yeah. So all of that for Eddie Murphy. Again, you can nominate your biggest box office bomb on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. Rob mentions after the original Star Wars, Disney tried to answer with Black Hole. What was the name of that?
The Black Hole.
It was The Black Hole.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, a forgettable film.
Yes, that was also around the time they did The Black Cauldron, too.
Is that a is the black hole a description of what happened to its prophet?
Pretty much.
With us, Sean Fennessy of The Ringer. Sean, do you have some other titles to add to our bomb list?
Well, I'm curious about, from the critics, actually, if a movie fails, does that recontextualize how you think about it? Do you have any kind of empathy for a performance around a movie? Because we can list 100 of these films, but I think we're never going to know the truth of how much they've lost. But the way that they live on is a part of the problem here.
Well, to Amy's point earlier, which is that we all pay too much attention to box office now, I think, even as with companies like Netflix in the mix, how well a movie's actually doing becomes is not being
reported.
So, you know, but something like, I remember this, Danny Boyle's movie Steve Jobs from 2015, which I actually think is a terrific picture.
Love that.
And
really?
Yes, really. As with every movie we've now named here that you kind of hate, Charles. Steve Jobs, I think, is a terrific movie that, you know, fell so short of expectations that in a lot of the conversations, even with colleagues, there was this reverse perception like, oh, yeah, that was bad. It just didn't work. And it's like, no, actually, it worked quite well. It just fell short of expectations. And so it shouldn't be, you know, if you don't like the movie, that's one thing. But I think there's sometimes this reverse correction where we're looking at, you know, where we mistakenly call something bad just because it didn't pay off financially.
I would agree with that. Even this week, the buzz on Shaft was so bad. And Justin and I both had to go buy a ticket and see it last night at the midnight showings.
Oh, critics were not invited to
special
screenings.
They were, but we couldn't make them.
You just couldn't. Yeah. Okay.
And I will say for myself, I was absolutely dreading seeing Shaft because the buzz on it was so bad. And I was much more positive than I expected.
Yeah,
walking
it wasn't
out
as terrible.
So it made you, in having the bar being lowered for you, made you a bit.
I know.
Kinder.
How am I just going
to
review in a bubble? That seems the safest.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Our Film Week critics this week, Amy Nicholson, Justin Chang, and Charles Solomon. Our thanks to Sean Fennessy. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate very much. Editor-in-Chief, Chief Content Officer at the pop culture and sports website and podcast network The Ringer. He hosts the Big Picture podcast. Have a terrific weekend from all of us at Film Week. I'll be away for our next Film Week program, and a guest host will be filling in for me. I have a lot of movies coming out next week. We'll get to those. You'll hear all about them on the next Film Week. Here on 89.3 KPCC.